ideas. Yay! A bit of an ideas interlude. Not so much stand up as sit down. And it requires your participation. Those of you who have phones in the house, perhaps you could take one out of your pocket and set it to go off in 20 minutes, because this is ideas to the clock. So you need to take it out, set it to go for 20 minutes. Ready, steady, go off in 20 minutes now.
That's it, now we just wait, basically. Okay, so yeah, this is Philosophy Slam. This is my friend and colleague, Mark Vernon. Mark is, among many things, an ex-priest, a philosopher, and a psychotherapist. So if anybody's going to mess with you tonight, it's going to be him.
And this is Robert Roland Smith, who too can claim to have done a lot of philosophy in his life, quite a lot of therapy too, with others. And he will also bring light and interest into your life.
Yeah, so the... in theory. Okay, so here's how it works. You call out a single word, and Mark and I will try our best to say something cogent about it. Okay? Now, it doesn't always work, and we both look like rabbits trapped in headlights sometimes. But, for example, so last night the first word that was called out was damnation. We also had the word socks and cunnilingus. So, the world is your oyster. What is the first word, please?
Turbulence.
So it's very interesting. There are two ways of thinking about turbulence. One is physical and one is psychological. We're all very familiar with the idea of turbulence on a plane. When you're flying through the air and you get bounced up and down. But from a psychological point of view, turbulence is very important, particularly from a psychoanalytic point of view. Because if you are Sigmund Freud, turbulence is exactly the thing that the psyche wants to resist. Because more than anything else, Freud will say, we want to keep things exactly the same. Equilibrium is what the psyche desires more than anything else. And this is why we repeat patterns. In other words, we do things the same in the same way, kind of on a more or less daily basis, precisely because we want to avoid turbulence, because turbulence is distressing to us. It's kind of molesting, it's perturbing of the psyche. And if you think about how we actually live our lives most of the time, the amount of repetition there is in our life is kind of pretty extraordinary, right down to socks, as we were talking about last night. We might put on our socks in the same way, in the same order, you know, every day that we get up, to even the thoughts that we'll have. You know, we might have even the same thoughts in the same way on a similar day, or the same kind of relationships with people. So turbulence is something that psyche strives to defy.
Turbulence in the physical world is also one of the most peculiar things that are studied now by physicists. It's all to do with chaos theory. And the point about chaos theory is it's not really chaotic. The turbulence is orientated around what are known as strange attractors. And these are actually one of the most mysterious bits of modern physics. If you, next time you're in the bath and you're like kicking your feet around and so on, and then you let the plug out, you'll notice there's turbulence, but it revolves around particular fixed points. And it's like somehow the atoms in the water are attracted towards these still points. No one knows quite how it works. And these strange attractors, they're slightly occult. It's a bit like when Newton first thought of gravity. There was this huge splurge of astrology because this guy was saying that bodies at a distance draw one another together. And no one quite knew what that meant. And strange attractors are a bit like that now when people try and understand this turbulence and chaos. So it's spooky in your mind and spooky in the world.
Next one.
Rabbits.
Rabbits, okay. So when we think about rabbits, we think about rabbits getting caught in headlights, but we also think about breeding, right? So rabbits breed more than any other kind of animal.
He
right?
does.
Right. And it's quite... Maybe I do. But it's quite interesting because, you know, these days, in terms of world population is going up. And so there's a real question for us, which is about how big the world population should become, how much people should be allowed to breed, actually. Now, this question is becoming more prominent for us as the kind of global resources are getting more stretched. But actually, there's a very interesting way of thinking about this idea of breeding and overpopulation. It comes to us really from a guy writing in the 18th century called Thomas Malthus, who was a kind of first theorist of kind of demography. And he, rather interestingly, came up with this theory that's often misunderstood. He said that he's often misunderstood as saying that people will have more children, they'll breed more when there are more resources, okay? That's the kind of common view, and it's the common mistaken view about Malthus, because he actually said it's the other way around. Rather weirdly, people tend to breed more when there are fewer resources, which is one of the arguments why people in lower social categories tend to have more kids. It's a quite interesting reversal of that argument about resources and breeding.
Another thing about rabbits is that funny test when you look at an image and you're not sure, is it a rabbit or is it a vase? You know, and it kind of flips between the two. And I think it's a very interesting illusion because I wonder whether it says something about the brain that isn't often thought about really, but maybe might explain rather a lot, which is not that the brain is a generator of consciousness, as is normally thought, but whether the brain is actually a filter of consciousness. So this is the idea, not that the brain, as it were, creates the sense of being me, you, I, here, this kind of epiphenomenon floating on top of neural networks firing away, but rather what's going on in the brain is receiving a kind of flow of consciousness that we're all embedded in, and it filters it out, it tries to make some sense of it, a bit like eyes do with light. You know, light kind of comes in and your eye makes some sense of it in conjunction with the brain. And so maybe what's going on when you look at those pictures of the rabbit flitting to a vase, flitting to a rabbit, flitting to a vase, is not your brain generating the consciousness, but your brain receiving consciousness and trying to make some sense of it.
I like it when you do your spooky voice, Mark. That's a new thing, isn't it?
I was about to break into my, is it Welsh or is it Indian? Is it Welsh?
Okay, so we've had,
Real,
as in R-E-A-L. Yeah. I thought it said veal to begin with. That got me off on a completely different track, you know. Okay, so there's all sorts of questions about what the real is, and some people say it's, you know, it's an internal thing, reality is just inside. Other people say it's outside. And I guess one of the most important thinkers on this is Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher, who talks about... So the word in German is das Ding an sich, the thing in itself. It's his way of talking about the real. And he says, can we ever really touch the real? Is it ever possible? And he actually comes up with the idea that we can never really touch the real, but what we have is a framework for understanding the world, and that is a kind of proxy for the real. So we never actually know if our perceptions are right, but as long as we have kind of good order in the mind, kind of good rationality, good reason, then we have a kind of good substitute for the real. But as for das Ding, you know, the Ding an sich, the thing in itself, that will always remain out of reach, and it's an illusion that we can never touch it.
And Kant, of course, comes in the early modern period, this sort of 17th, 18th century period, when a lot of the old medieval and ancient philosophical ideas are overturned. And in particular, Kant is overturning what Plato thought about the real. You may well have heard of his myth of the cave, this idea that we think what's real is in front of us, but actually we're in a rather dark room, strapped down in our seats.
There you go again.
Something's happening tonight.
I'm going to do a spooky voice next time.
So his idea is that we're in a cave and we're staring in the back and we can't look around and we think this is freedom, but all we're seeing actually is shadows on the back of the cave wall. But a few individuals manage to turn around and they see there's a fire behind them, and in front of the fire are these puppets dancing, and it's the puppets dancing that are causing the shadows to be projected on the back of the cave. They get very interested and they manage to, with great courage and fearlessness, find their way around the fire, and then they see that there's a kind of distant, beautiful, even glow ahead of them, and they get drawn towards that. It seems more beautiful than the fire, more beautiful than the shadows. And that drawing of the beauty draws them towards what, of course, is the mouth of the cave. They step out of the cave and then they see the sun. And of course, they had no idea that there was this reality outside the cave, this extraordinary sort of beautiful light falling on everything and bringing it all to life. Never would have guessed that, stuck at the back of the cave. And the idea, of course, is that it's an analogy for what life is like for us most of the time, and that the real is really something really very different, but we have to go on this sort of journey of transformation that requires courage in order to come and perceive the real.
Glitter. Glitter, not Gary. just being clear. So we think of glitter as being something kind of superfluous, or, you know, something decorative, okay? Oh no, essential in your view, okay. Okay. Well, this is very interesting, because that goes to one of the most kind of fundamental distinctions in the history of ideas, which is between the essence, you know, something fundamental, and something ornate, something decorative, something superficial, and so on. So it's interesting in your case that you've effectively reversed the entire history of ideas there by by saying that glitter is essential. But all of those things, you know, like, you know, glittering lights are supposed to be illusion, you know, artificial light, glitter. And, you know, in certain traditions, they're thought of as kind of work of the devil, because we shouldn't be, we shouldn't be distracted by these things. We should be only ever in this kind of open plane of truth and true light and true reason. And things like glitter, particularly in certain puritanical traditions, if you think about the Amish and so on, you know, even wearing buttons is considered, you know, ungodly. So, you know, glitter would, you know, have you in the kind of pit of hell within a few minutes, basically. So glitter is something that, you know, you're playing fast and loose with in terms of your moral future.
Little did you also know you were quoting Plato by being worried about glitter, because Plato too was worried about glitter. When he tells his story about leaving the cave and going and seeing the real, the beautiful, the good and the true, as he puts it, the very next thing that happens is that a chap called Alcibiades walks in the room, and he was drunk, he was wearing a big mask, and he was covered in glitter, surrounded by girls playing flutes. And the idea is, Plato is saying, just when you think you might have seen the vision of everything, you might actually just be seeing a big sparkle, a big blur. It might just be like Alcibiades walking in the room covered in glitter. And he said, so the key thing is to be able to discern what you're really seeing. It's not that straightforward. It's kind of a message for those who think they can take a shortcut to spiritual enlightenment by taking some sort of glitter-inducing drugs.
Yeah, there's also a link between glitter and deception. You know, the phrase, you know, all that glitters is not gold. And I think that's, you know, that's quite an important idea, that deception and glitter, you know, be careful of people who are glittering and sparkling, because, you know, although they seem very sweet on the surface... In fact, they could be quite malevolent in their dark heart.
Okay. Next word.
Nailed it.
What was that? Ooh.
Poo.
Poo.
It's time for a bit of scatological reflection.
Okay, so there's one definition of civilization, which is that you can measure that civilization is the distance between a human being and their poo. Right? Which I think is, you know, it's quite a good definition. In fact, it reminds me of a. A guy I know who has, he's part of this club, no, not that kind of club, where you, it's a club where you have to, you go to as many countries as possible in the world, right? So there's a club for people who compete in terms of how many countries that they visit. In fact, there are more countries now in the world than there's ever been before because the countries are dividing and so on. Anyway, so this club sort of decide, you know, had to decide what was the criterion for having visited a country. Okay, is it enough to have gone through the airport or not? Okay, does that constitute visiting a country? And they had a kind of referendum on this group, and they said, no, the thing that defines having visited a country is whether or not you've taken a poo in it or not.
I'm going to borrow something from the philosopher... Have you read any Slavoj Zizek, who's a very sort of erudite, entertaining philosopher? And he makes very interesting observations about toilets. We're getting close to bum jokes now, I think. He makes a very interesting observation about different kinds of toilets in different countries. So, for example, you notice if you go to Germany, you poo on a kind of platform, and then the water flushes it off. Yeah. If you go to France, you poo in a tube that kind of makes it disappear, so you can't even have a look at it. And if you poo in this country, then it sort of floats around and you have to sort of try and track it. You're not quite sure what you should be doing. So poo actually goes to the heart of our national character.
Yes. Not just the heart. Okay, next one.
It's dandelions.
Ooh. Dandelions. Okay, dandelions are beautiful, phenomena of nature, beautiful flora. Because one of the things we think about when we think about dandelions is clocks, right? Because, you know, there's that thing you do as a child. You pick up a dandelion and you blow it, and the number of... whatever they are, stamens, things left on them, is supposed to tell you the... Pardon?
Seeds,
thank you. The number of bits left on it is supposed to tell you the time, okay? But it's interesting because nature itself, if you think about our notion of time in general, we tend to associate time with clocks, with timepieces, you know, with watches and so on, like the watches we're looking at, you know, on your countdowns. But if you think about it, a tree, for example, is a clock. Because what it's telling you, it's recording the passage of time. It's measuring and showing you that time has passed. Well, deciduous trees will tell you that time has passed, right? So it sheds its leaves in autumn, becomes bare over the winter, renews itself in the spring, becomes much fuller in the summer, and so on. So although its rhythm is slower than a wristwatch and so on, a tree is effectively a clock, as is all of nature. Because, you know, time is not contained in a clock. A clock is merely a measure of time. Time itself is, we can't touch it. You know, it doesn't exist anywhere. We only have the things which measure it or in some way give us some representation of it. So the dandelion sort of reminds us of the fact that clocks are everywhere insofar as change is everywhere, and we can measure it and see it, kind of observe it going through these various transient states.
Clocks also cut reality up, and dandelions might be thought of doing the same kind of thing, the flower now. Because is it a flower or is it a weed? When they sprout up on my path in my back garden, sometimes I wonder, should I not take the spray gun, you know, with weed killer in it? Should I let them sort of bloom like flowers? Or are they weeds? And I'm not quite sure which they are. We can blame this cutting up of reality, rather than, as it were, just contemplating things as they are in themselves, on Plato's great student, Aristotle, who most of Aristotle's works actually are to do with the natural world. They're to do with animals and with plants that Alexander the Great sent back to him when he was conquering the known world. He sent back him endless specimens, and Aristotle and his school sort of worked them out, put them into groups, and they came up with notions of species and categories, these kind of ways that we very spontaneously now think of, is it a flower, is it a weed? And we naturally cut the world up in much the same way that we cut the world up with time as well. Before, people didn't do that. It's rather interesting to think what life might have been like before you cut it up and said, that's this and not that. But Aristotle got that all going.
Smoothies. What I like about the word smoothies is it's almost onomatopoeic. You know, it almost gives you a sense of what it is you're about to drink. You know, smoothies, you know, as if you're kind of crushing the fruit as you're saying the word, you know. But it's interesting. I lived in LA for a while where smoothie culture is kind of is everywhere, right? Yeah, everywhere you go, you can get a smoothie. And it's quite interesting because it's kind of cognate with the idea of making everything easy. You know, you can't actually eat an apple. You can't actually chop up a piece of fruit. Everything has to be squidged up. It's almost like baby food. It's got an adult version of baby food, really, a smoothie, if you think about it. You know, it's not a huge amount of difference. So it's very much part of that kind of post-war kind of fantasy about not just labor saving, but making life as easy as possible, almost as if human beings could have all kind of motor functions taken away from them and just sort of brought to them. Because in principle, you know, I mean, people in hospitals also drink their food mushed up too. You know what I mean? There's something about a kind of disabling of the human being that goes on when we make things as easy as possible through the kind of smoothification of the world.
And in fact, Epicurus, another ancient philosopher, Epicurus, known for Epicureanism, he would have thought, I think, that smoothies are a sign of a degenerate civilization as well. He really felt that you should, as he said, you should be able to take as much pleasure in a glass of water and a barley cake as Zeus feasting on Mount Olympus, drinking all his smoothies and, you know, all the rest of it. He thought that you should really go for less is more is what counts in life, not more is more. So when you walk into the cafe and they say, you know, it's not even just like a strawberry and banana smoothie, it's a pomegranate seed with mango and God knows what else. You know, that they're overselling you. It's part of a degenerate culture, and you must resist the smoothie. And particularly innocent smoothie, I think, who dress it up as if you're doing some good for the world. You're really not. A glass of water and a barley cake is what it counts.
I didn't know we'd be so passionately against smoothies, both of us. So we found out about each other tonight. Okay. Eyebrows, what a great subject. So, I mean, one basic question is kind of what are eyebrows for, right? I mean, you know, we have all sorts of sort of functions on our body, and some of them are, you know, some of them are kind of legacies from earlier systems, like the appendix, for example. It's something we can apparently all get rid of because, you know, it's like an appendix, you know what I mean? But eyebrows too. I mean, what really is the function of eyebrows? So there is some argument that they are there, you know, purely to kind of interrupt the flow of sweat down the brow. But essentially what they've become more than anything else is kind of forms of adornment. Again, we're back a little bit to this idea of glitter. So whatever else they are, you know, they're one of those bodily functions that we are sort of increasingly thinking of as kind of non-essential decorative kind of function. And indeed, as people sort of play with their bodies more and more, that's one of the aspects that are, you know, becoming more and more, you know, fiddled around with.
Male nipples.
Thank you.
No, actually, I'm rather fascinated by eyebrows. Did you watch that film? Did you watch that film, The Lobster? Yeah, with the Colin Firth. I had no idea what that film was about, but what it kept me going was Colin Firth's eyebrows. He's got really dancing, moving, kind of interesting eyebrows. They're rather thick and attractive. I've got a bit of a thing for monobrows, actually. I'm very attractive. And one of the reasons why I decided I was quite interested in was because St. Paul, you know, the great founder of the Christian church, St. Paul, one of the few things that's remembered about his appearance is that he had a monobrow. So if you've got a monobrow, you can change the world. Don't lock them.
They're very expressive. Yours are very expressive.
Mine are very expressive. Thank you very much. Can you do that?
Another word.
Adventure.
Adventure.
Okay. We had adventure and boobs. We're going with adventure. Boobs is an adventure of itself, of course. The word adventure comes from a Latin word, you know, advent. It comes from the word for things to arrive, you know. So the important thing, there's a French philosopher called Jacques Derrida who writes a lot about this word, venir in French, you know, the idea of what arrives. And he says the really important thing about an adventure, any kind of adventure, is that you don't know what's going to happen. Right, the more you plan what's going to happen, the less of an adventure it's going to be. So the idea of kind of Googling every hotel you're going to go to, planning your itinerary, you know, the more you do that, the less of an adventure you're going to be having. And Walter Benjamin, who's kind of writing about 100 years ago, says the art of travel consists entirely in the art of getting lost, right? Because adventure is about lostness, and lostness is the only state in which we begin to learn. You know, you can't learn in the state of mastery, not almost by definition, right? You've got to be kind of like a child if you want to learn. And there's something about adventure which is necessarily childish. And you've probably had that feeling being abroad, that frustrating feeling of, you know,
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
The adventure continues.
Exactly. Thank you very much.